Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Hey, welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I'm your host, John Lossowoff. Joining me, as always, are my co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
So I'm dreaming the other night, and, I'm in this boiler room. I'm walking around. There's this really jerky guy harassing me. You know, like I walk around a corner. I think he's there. He's not there. I turn around. He's there. Then I turn around again. He's not there. He's just basically messing with me, right? Mm-hmm. And, it goes on a little bit. I'm getting kind of annoyed, but I get cornered. And he has me. This creepy dude, claws with hands, has me cornered, right? And I think I'm toast. When out of nowhere, Kurt Russell comes out of nowhere, punches this creature once in the chin, knocks him out. He leads me to a bar, and I get drunk in my dreams.
Oh, nice.
That sounds like Big Trouble in Freddy's Revenge.
Yeah. It was crazy. It was great. Great dream.
I was really going to ask you. I was going to interrupt you and say, "Where is Kurt Russell in this dream?"
I mean, he came out of nowhere and saved the day. Like he chin checked him. Yeah. Like Freddy kind of saw him coming, so it wasn't like a total cheap shot. I think he kind of went, "Hey, Freddy," so Freddy would look at him, so it wasn't like a cheap shot because Kurt Russell is an honorable man. Mm-hmm. And he just like, boom, and Freddy's arms just went straight out. You know when people get knocked out and they go into like, boom! And then he just like fell backwards. You know, hit his head. It was great.
I've heard this. Like, people have nightmares about Freddy Krueger. Freddy Krueger has nightmares about Kurt Russell.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah.
Forktop Express running him over.
Yeah.
Pops out of a Stargate and just levels him.
I'm not sure, but I feel like somewhere in our first 5 or 8 episodes, we once answered the question of what does Freddy have nightmares about? I feel like Kurt Russell. That was a question.
Oh, yeah. I said John Wick.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Ooh. Actually, I wouldn't mind dreaming about John Wick. I would be thoroughly entertained every night.
He'd be murdering people and drinking bourbon.
Yeah. John Levingood, say hi to everyone.
Hey, everybody. So I just marathon watched over 3 days Wayward Pines season 1.
Yeah.
How was that?
That movie starts out, by the way, like it just feels like some weird mystery, some modern Hitchcockian mystery, and it basically ends up as The Descent above ground.
Yep.
Like,
I'm going to sing something, though. Guess who's back? Back again. M. Night's back.
Oh.
Tell a friend. Guess who's back? M. Night's back. Guess who's back?
I thought he did a good job with The Visit.
Yeah, I know. He's back. M. Night's back. I've been championing him for years, going, he's
back?
Making a comeback.
I don't know. I mean, you could still be in a slump. Or you can still get, like, ahead and still be in a slump.
He's back. He's back.
If I had a criticism of that show, though, like, the way that they wrapped it up is that the cliffhanger that they left us with, I don't really care if I see how it works out. Like, I feel that they wrapped up all the things that I wanted to see the answers for. Like, they eventually gave me all the answers that I wanted, and then it turned into The Descent above ground with Abbeys. Like, it made me think of Downton Abbey, which is an aberration, these monsters. Like above ground, and then I'm just thinking, like, yeah, I'm completely satisfied with that. This is way better than like Hemlock Grove, which left me angry at the end of season 1. I didn't watch season 2. Like, totally pleased.
I'm a wayward guy. Carry on our wayward. That's a show that actually did better on DVR. Like the overnight ratings weren't that good, but they exploded on DVR and it made like, and they were trying to bury it, Fox was, and then it exploded and they're like, oh yeah, we loved Wayward the whole time. It's been great. Yeah, yeah. Like, we knew that was going to happen. But now they want a second season, which really isn't possible. But
you know what? I'll bet like everyone was going online saying, yo, did you see Wayward Pines? And like 99% of people were like, what the hell is that? They'd be like, that new M. Night Shyamalan show. And they're like,
Shyamalan.
Oh, shit. I got to go get on that.
That's right. I think every year they should make a show where Matt Dillon just walks around a town acting confused and punching people in the face. Like, where am I? Pop. Where am I?
I miss Entourage.
He's a very believable
douchebag.
Guy. Well,
Yeah, come on.
Not in this show, though. He was good in that show.
Right.
And, well, I would watch one where his Something About Mary character walks around punching people in the face. That'd be pretty
That was actually what I thought about, was that character.
I was thinking Beautiful Girls, that movie where he's like, why do we always mess with the good ones? Just give me Matt Dillon punching people in the face every season. I'm happy.
Yeah. Anyway, let me go. I think you got listener questions for us this week, right?
I do. My first question comes from my cousin Ryan from Lake Alfred, Florida. And he asks a little Star Wars question. He asks, if a Sith had a crotch blaster like Sex Machine, which was Tom Savini from Dusk Till Dawn, would he win every single lightsaber duel? Because he could just lock blades with his opponent and then just crotch shot the shit out of him, as he puts it.
Here's the problem with that. How many Jedis and Siths in the Star Wars universe have lost their appendages during lightsaber duels? Right? It's always like the hand that they're holding lightsaber in. I'm assuming the lightsaber would be coming from the crotch. And it's just like, why would you even want to risk that?
No. He has a crotch blaster in addition to having a lightsaber.
That seems dangerous. How does it go off? Like when they're locked up in their blades, does he just start pelvic thrusting? Like, I think the other Jedi would see that coming.
You know, in the movie, they made it in Dusk Till Dawn, they made it seem like he could just think that and it would happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we're kind of getting into Spaceballs territory, and look what happened to Rick Moranis. Right? Because like, they straight up took their lightsabers from their crotch when they did it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and he lost. So, I mean, all right, but I am thinking something. If you think about the Sith, though, like, if you think about the good Jedis, they just have the stock lightsaber. But the Sith, Darth Maul had the double-sided because he was probably, you know, he wanted to have one free end to watch out for crotch shots. And then this new guy, Ken Ryu or whatever his name is,
Is it Kylo Ren?
Yeah, Kylo Ren, something like that. And his thing is kind of fancy. Like, it kind of busts out on the side. Hmm. So I feel like the Sith are much more prepared for crotch blasters. You know what I mean?
But here's the thing. The Sith is also a bad guy. Historically speaking, bad guys in the Star Wars universe cannot shoot for shit. So I feel like even if he's got like a crotch blaster, like he would still find some way to miss.
Yeah. But how about this? What if he just puts the crotch blaster on auto fire and then just starts swinging his lightsaber? And then the Jedi has to decide, is he going to deflect these blaster shots or is he going to defend against the lightsaber?
He would just defend against the lightsaber because like the auto fire would still miss. Like it would shoot everything around the Jedi. Except
he'd just
the Jedi.
Shake his hips around. It would be firing all over the place.
Yeah, he would miss the Jedi every time.
Like, what if they chop that thing off? Like, because their arms are always getting lost. Why not the blaster? Like, because a lot of arms are lost. Like, that Hoth Wampa loses an arm. Luke loses an arm.
Yeah, seriously. So many limbs and appendages are just lost throughout all these movies.
And, you know, we might see Darth Maul in the third trilogy section, because like in the fiction canon, which is considered Star Wars canon, when he made it down there, he wasn't dead and they gave him like robotic lower body.
Oh yeah.
Gosh, so a Darth Maul with a double lightsaber crotch blasting at me
with robot legs.
Like, I feel like that's like Austin Powers. Remember that scene where he's seducing the robots?
Yeah,
that's
like,
right.
Like, maybe it's the Force like that instead of a gun. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I like John's answer. I think the bullets would miss, and I think they would lose a very important appendage.
quick digression. A buddy of mine who loves playing video games, apparently there's a new Star Wars game that came out recently. I guess it's like one of the like online multiplayer games. Like, whenever he's on the Stormtrooper side, he just intentionally misses the good guys every time. His teammates just yell at him, why aren't you killing anybody? Because I'm a stormtrooper. I can't hit anybody.
You can't be deadly with that.
No.
I do love that scene, though, where Han Solo like chases about 40 stormtroopers, and then they're like, wait a second. And then they turn around and they start chasing him. Yeah. Yeah, so I think, plus with all of Darth Maul's, like, his stuff is based on movement. Like, he's not going to stay long enough just to, like, you know, do some thrusts. Yeah. So, I don't know. I think a lot of Sith have died because of that. So I'm thinking, you know, no.
How do we know Darth Vader doesn't have a crotch blaster himself? you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of like how we didn't know R2-D2 had, like, jet boosters until we saw him in the prequel trilogy.
He was pretty much like a Swiss Army knife, R2-D2 was. So
how do we know Darth Vader was just, like, he just didn't use, like, all of his tools that were available to him? You know, maybe he had a crotch blaster.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I agree. Yeah. He didn't really need it.
No, I guess when you can force choke people, a crotch blaster is kind of redundant.
It's overkill.
He chokes him, and then he shoots you with his crotch.
Grand Tarkin. He starts choking him. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we kind of answered that.
Yeah, maybe? I got to say, though, that was an oddly insightful movie crossover question.
I like it.
We went in-depth. I don't think we fully answered it, but I think we answered it enough.
Yeah, we went all in, jumped in the Sarlacc pit, and came out somewhat alive.
Yeah.
So after that extremely specific scenario, here's a very broad one. At the Dark Hours from Twitter of the Dark Hours podcast asks, hey, random horror question. What season has the best horror movies? Is it Halloween, Christmas, Valentine's Day? When?
So I'm going to go not with, like, the best movies. Like, you know, Halloween would win. But I'm going to go with Christmas.
Because of quantity? Because
Gremlins.
Yeah.
Rare Exports and Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah, because they take place during Christmas, right? So technically speaking, they are Christmas movies.
Yeah, like Gremlins, when she talks about why she, like, hates Christmas because her dad fell down the chimney and snapped her neck in Gremlins, like, I love that. In Rare Exports, like, these, like, old naked Norwegian Santa men are, like, chasing down little kids. It's like a kid empowerment movie, and, like, Santa's eating people. And then Nightmare Before Christmas, man. Love it.
Yeah.
So I'm going Christmas.
It's not a horror movie, but Die Hard's my favorite Christmas movie. You know.
That's ho.
If you think about it, Christmas with the Cranks and Surviving Christmas are, like, the worst movies I've ever seen in my life.
So
I mean, you could look at them as, like, terrible and horrible as well.
Yeah. I want to say maybe Valentine's Day also has some decent kind of horror movies. You know, obviously My Bloody Valentine, right?
And then also the movie Valentine, not that it was good.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I can't think of any other holiday. I don't know, maybe Eli Roth never made, actually never made Thanksgiving, did he?
No.
Like, it was just a trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see.
Well, they did the turkey. Didn't they do, like, Thanksgiving with that turkey?
Yeah, I don't know.
I've heard a lot about that movie, but I never want to watch it.
I've never seen that. One day I might finally give in and see that. And yeah. I got to say, it's not really a holiday, but the time frame between New Year's Day and Valentine's Day, that is the gray area when no real blockbusters are released. And actually, if you look at the big number of horror releases in a year.
Oh, wait.
That's when it happens.
Is he saying the best time of the year for horror releases?
Well, that's how I'm taking it. He just said what season. He said what season has the best horror movies. But I'm going with the fact that so many horror releases disproportionately happen in that time. I misanswered that as the best season for horror movies. Like, for releases, because that's when you get a load of releases.
That's interesting, because if you think about January, they call it, like, the dumping ground of movies.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that, like, they put out a lot of horror movies in January, statistically.
Almost every January and February, you're going to find 3 to 5 horror releases per month, and you will see nothing close to that any other month of the year, including October.
Interesting.
Huh.
I'm saying Gremlins.
I'm saying, but I like that, though, because Gremlins, and I'd forgot until you said it that, yeah, Gremlins was also a Christmas movie.
Dude, there's a scene where this mom kills, like, 4 gremlins. She, like, blends them and, like, she murders 4 gremlins, like, in the microwave.
It's a PG movie. It's all right.
Yeah. It explodes in the microwave and you see it.
And they kill an old woman. They shoot her out of her house.
Did she actually? We don't know that she died.
How could you live through that? Like, because this movie kind of goes with the laws of death. You know what I mean? Like, She flew out of her home, and then no one's going to get her, so she's going to freeze to death with all her battle wounds. Like, you fly out of a house like that.
She was mean, too. She'd probably, like, be like, help me! And someone would be like, oh, my gosh, this poor old lady, let me help. And she'd be like, help me faster! And they'd be like, screw this old lady.
Help me faster.
Nah, she's a tough old gal. She can handle it.
She's going to crawl in and kill one of the gremlins.
Yeah,
they didn't shut up. That movie, though, it had so much weird, sick stuff. Because, like, okay, when Gizmo got wet and he multiplied, okay, that was kind of cute, the little popping little fur balls, whatever. And then they ate later, though, and then they turned into these like weird, like alien cocoon slimy weird things. And then when the adult gremlins got wet, like they got all bubbly, they were damn near melting, and they had these little bubbles on their back, and they're turning into more gremlins. That was gross, dude. That was not PG material.
No.
Well, I think it was released before the actual PG-13 rating came out, so it was a hard PG.
Maybe that should have gotten nudged into R.
It was a hard PG.
It was a hard PG.
It was a hard PG.
It's like, yeah. Punisher Warzone's a hard R.
Yeah,
like,
it's a hard R.
I want to call it a soft R. I saw a lot of horror, like zombie movies in particular, from the early 80s that were rated R. And yes, okay, they were gory, but they were so dumb. They weren't even very credible. Like, the bubbly-backed gremlins, when they got wet, and those slimy cocoons they had, and getting exploded in a microwave and getting blended by the mom, all that feels more real than the nonsense gore of a zombie getting its head blown up.
Joe Dante.
Yeah. It was just a really fun movie.
Joe Dante pulled like a Poltergeist Spielberg with that rating board.
Yeah.
So we're going to go with Blender for the
Blender
answer. Yeah.
Blender is the best season for holiday movies.
Yeah. Look it up. All right. I think that does it for listener questions for now. I think we did a pretty spectacular job, gentlemen. Give yourself a pat on the back there.
I was giving myself a pat on the back when you were telling me to give myself a pat on the back. So now I have two arms patting my back. I'm doing like a me hug.
All right. Well, while Mark is busy congratulating himself there, living good. Why don't you tell the audience what our topic is today?
Well, you know, a lot of times we will discuss themes in horror movies, or we will discuss individual movies to ludicrous detail. But it's seldom that we actually address the synthesis between multiple movies in a franchise. And for the followers of our website, by the way, Mark has recently brought some increased attention specifically to horror sequels and horror franchises in two analytical articles where he actually statistically weighed some of the best sequels and franchises. And today we're going to talk about two franchises in detail. But, I mean, Mark, would you like to give a quick rundown of what you actually did instead of just making a best of list? You actually crunched some numbers with an analyst, as I understand it.
Well, it all started with a 21st Century Horror post. Now, we'll see. For me, I think it's easy to write a best of list. I do. I think, you know, we all have it. We've all done it. I've read some very credible best of lists, but it all started when I wanted to figure out the best 21st Century Horror films. And so I broke down all the critical data for those. But then, you know, that hit big, as you all know. And so I started to think about, hey, what could be a follow-up? Like, I didn't want to rip anything off, and so I figured best franchises. So I got with my cousin Jeremy. We should get him on here to explain this. Sorry, Jeremy. We'll get you on sometime, and you can break it all down. He's a data wrangling wizard. And so I collected 24 franchises worth of box office and their critical and audience ratings. Then Jeremy fixed, like, you know, he put them in a big list, you know, 247.
Ooh, good job,
figured
Jeremy.
We figured out all their ROIs. He did an ROI rank, and then he also...
And when you say ROI, what are you referring to?
So return on investment. So obviously, like, Jaws had, you know, Paranormal Activity, Jaws had the best return on investment. So Paranormal Activity cost $15,000, and let's just say domestically it made $110 million.
Ooh,
so the return Jaws made $1 billion...
You said Jaws actually had a higher ROI than...
No, it didn't. Paranormal Activity was one. Then Jaws, Psycho, Exorcist. So Jaws made $1 billion just in the States. And so we, what we did was we figured out the ROI. And so Paranormal Activity, the ROI rank was obviously, you know, if we had 147 films, it was 147. So we had like the ROI rank out of all the 247, I'm sorry, it had the ROI rank. And we went through, well, Jeremy did this, but I collected the data, he analyzed it. And so we went through critics, audiences. We did an Amazon weighted score because Amazon, they traditionally score higher than any other website. Like, you know, Freddy 3 or Nightmare on Elm Street 3 was like 100%. So we did a weighted average on that. You know, Shawshank Redemption is 91. Hmm. So, you know, it's just pretty interesting. So we did a weighted average.
Hey, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3 is legitimately
better
than Shawshank. Everybody
knows
that.
So you think it's 100% worthy.
Yeah. And so... you know, we averaged, so Jeremy averaged the Rotten Tomatoes, the Metacritic, the IMDb, the Amazon weighted score, and the ROI rank, and we figured out the greatest franchises, sequels, and remakes, statistically speaking. And why it was so important to me to do franchises is I wanted to know which franchise, with all its bumps and bruises, because every single horror franchise has, like, you know, they look like... If Rocky was actually in a real boxing match and he got hit that many times by Ivan Drago, that's what a horror series would look like, that many bumps and bruises, because there's been some really bad films. And I kind of wanted to know, like, obviously Jaws 1 made a lot of money, but I want to know how Jaws 2, 3, and 4 did in comparison. Not well. And so we ended up figuring out that The Evil Dead was the best horror franchise. Then we figured out that either Silence of the Lambs, if you think it's a sequel, or Aliens are the best horror sequels. And the best horror remake was David Cronenberg's The Fly. And I like these lists, not because it's like, yeah, I think this is number one. I think they are backed up by data. I think that we got the best from every source we could possibly find. And I like the ROI just simply because, you know, if you did like Underworld and Resident Evil and those kind of bigger movies, you know, they have $40 million budgets and they make $40 million back at the domestic box. Oh, we only looked at domestic box office because international is impossible. But if you, you know, look at the budgets, I want to know which movies made the most money, you know, return on investment. And so we broke that all down, had a lot of data. And the following franchises we're going to talk about actually were, you know, they were in the top 10 of everything except remakes because the Nightmare – oh, I'll let you talk about that, John. But they were in the top 10 of the best sequels and the best franchises. So these are two franchises that are, you know, legit phenomenons. And I think that's kind of important to talk about during Halloween time.
So I actually called just a couple specific numbers from your articles. And so you made the point about Jaws, and anyone who listens knows that Mark loves Jaws.
Greatest
and
movie.
Jaws as a franchise did not make his top 15 horror franchise list at all, even though the first Jaws made over $1 billion. And I got a quote, and that was that Jaws 2, 3, and 4 averaged $143 million. And that's really good. But if you combine Jaws 2, 3, and 4's box office, domestic box office, you really only get about a third of Jaws 1, which came out earlier. And that, yeah, return on investment may have been positive, but it really doesn't shine very brightly for growth and development for that franchise.
Yeah, and you know, I think I put that chart in the post.
Wait, stop right there. I got to stop you. Folks, you need to go to moviesfilmsandflicks.com, that's Flicks with an X, and see some of these graphs that Mark has put up to illustrate these trends, because they're very simple and very powerful, these graphs. It's almost soul-crushing what you see, what happens to some of these franchises over time. I'm sorry, Mark. Please keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have one chart here. You know, after Jeremy got all the data and he sent it over to me, and, you know, and congrats on your kid, by the way. He listened to the podcast. You're going to have an awesome kid.
Congrats, Jeremy.
Yeah. And I hope the family's great. And we'll get you on sometime. Don't worry about it. So I have a chart here with Jaws, The Exorcist, The Amityville Horror, Poltergeist, and Psycho. And what I did was I showed their decline from first film to prior films. And from all those series, there's a massive drop-off in box office. But then I showed the series, you know, Evil Dead. Evil Dead's only franchise to double its box office with each film. So it went from like 2.5 to 5 to 12 to actually a lot more than that. It went to about 45. And so
I've got your numbers for parts 1 through 3 and then the remake. It's 6, 12, 22, and 55.
Yeah, so like no remake really has made more money than the original, which is pretty crazy. And I hate to do this because we know John loves Hellraiser, and Hellraiser actually made money with every theatrical release. But I showed the kind of box office decline as opposed to Evil Dead and Hellraiser. So Evil, yes, Hellraiser made money, but it had a pretty steady decline. Now, Evil Dead just skyrockets. So, you know, with this franchise information, it's actually pretty reliable because it just sort of speaks to the numbers. And one thing I kept finding out, you know, in every top 10 and every top 5, Nightmare on Elm Street was a really solid competitor.
Oh, yeah. Nightmare on Elm Street's, they affect me over and over again. And sort of the Evil Dead's, but yeah, I'm a huge fan of the Evil Dead franchise. I'm sorry. Well, that, the Evil Dead franchise, but also the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise very much. And is it to, hey, wait, they're actually connected. Because in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, there's a scene from Evil Dead.
Yeah, and they had like a little back and forth going on together. And also, if Nightmare on Elm Street would have stopped after four films, it would have been alongside Evil Dead, because the first four Nightmare on Elm Street films made with inflation, $59 million, $66 million, $93 million, and $97 million. So aside, you know, the first four films of every horror franchise, the only two franchises to make money, you know, to have more box office is Evil Dead and Nightmare on Elm Street. So, I mean, both these, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street was a legit phenomenon. And we've talked about the first one with Wes Craven, but I don't think we dove into the rest of the films.
That's right, yeah. And for anyone wondering what we were just talking about, that we actually did a Wes Craven special podcast episode. We did talk a lot about Nightmare on Elm Street Part 1, which that was in our episode 28, by the way, for anyone who cares. And today, we're going to talk a little bit more about two of Wes Craven's franchises, which kind of makes this our Wes Craven tribute Part 2 in a way.
Yeah. And also, just so you guys know, there's only four horror series to make money compared to the original. So what I did was, you know, I looked at Evil Dead. Evil Dead, the average of that was $2.5 million. But then the average of the other Evil Dead movies was $30 million. So, you know, Evil Dead made 2.5, and the average of the other three Evil Dead films were 30. So the only horror series to do that were the Hannibal franchise, Evil Dead franchise, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Resident Evil. So Nightmare on Elm Street actually, the series average is over what the first one made. So it's proven that this thing has legs and tongues and claws. Gross, stretchy stuff.
Yeah.
There are so many tongues in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise.
There's tongues through phones. In New Nightmare, she gets wrapped with a tongue around her face.
It's like, where did the prop department get all these tongues?
In part two, Jesse gets possessed by Freddy, and he drops this big, long purple tongue on his girlfriend's chest. Like, there's a lot of tongues. And then Freddy's just flicking his tongue, kind of like, I don't know, some pervy dude or something every now and then in his movies. There's a lot of tongue action. And in part three, the nurse gets that mute kid. She kind of corners him and seduces him. And then after she's got him laying down on this little, like, hospital bed. She's spitting projectile tongues that tie the kid up in bondage.
Oh, yeah.
There are tongues all over the place in this franchise.
This is interesting. And I just watched the documentary, was it Never Sleep Again? It's 4 hours long, but it covers every single Nightmare on Elm Street film. I haven't gotten to I don't know if they cover the remake, but I'm getting to Freddy vs. Jason right now. And what I think is most impressive about Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and 3 are the most of the budgets went to the set pieces and the gore. Like Nightmare on Elm Street 3, which is actually the number 5, statistically speaking, sequel of all time, is actually all the budget went to special effects. And it might be one of the it might be the fan favorite of Nightmare on Elm Street because it is so loaded with, you know, like a group of likable kids and a ton of special effects.
I'm kind of curious
Nightmare
now.
On Elm Street. Oh, go ahead.
I'm kind of curious now. I want to see someone make a chart of the use of tongues in the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. I feel like it would just be like a rising linear line. It's just like
that's typical. Like, is it? Do you mean like the number of tongues?
Yeah, just the number, the intensity, the amount of flicking. I don't know.
I think we should because I think they're all on Netflix, and we could just fast forward and chart that, and I can make an infographic. I swear, if anybody here is listening to this and they take that idea,
there really are a lot of trends in Wes Craven movies in general, but especially in his. Well, they're not all his. He really, the only one that was truly his was Part One. But in these Nightmare on Elm Street movies, more than any other franchise, must I say that the different directors, because it's like a different director for every movie.
Yeah, and a lot of them did good work, like later on. Like this is like a testing ground for directors. And what I love about these movies, so I'm looking at the budgets right now, and these movies had dirt cheap budgets. Like we're talking, let me go down here. These are like some of the most money making independent films. So the first one was $1.8 million. The second one was $2.2 million. These are not adjusted. Wait, are these adjusted for inflation? No, these are not adjusted. Oh wait, no, they're not adjusted for inflation. But I mean, at the time, these were very cheap movies to make. So you had $4.5 million, you had $7 million. These were not expensive movies. And so what they did on a budget, you know why they would hire directors? You know why they hired Rennie Harlan for the fourth Nightmare on Elm Street? They looked at him and they're like, he's big. He doesn't have much money. He'll work really hard for us and he won't die.
There you go.
Did you know that? They're like looking at him like, he can survive this shoot because like these shoots are massive, special effect driven, which takes a lot of time films, and they wore all their crews out. So so that's why they kind of hired younger directors because they knew they could work their butts off.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned the special effects driven, and we were talking about tongues. And in Nightmare on Elm Street Part 1, when Nancy is holding the tongue, or the phone, and she hears Freddy's voice on the other end of the phone, and the camera pans out, and you see, like, Freddy's mouth and his tongue are at the receiver, at the speaker end of the phone. That effect, I think it took $5 or $10. Like, Wes Craven was joking about how immensely inexpensive that effect was, and it was one of the most off-putting, shocking, unexpected effects of the whole movie.
Interesting. But they also almost killed his crew with that blood geyser bed.
Oh, from the first movie.
Yeah, the blood geyser bed, and also when Tina dies, when she's kind of rotating along the walls and the ceilings, they used a rotating room for that.
They used the same room for both of those stunts, those gags that they call them.
Wow.
So the exploding bed gag and then the Tina getting dragged around the room gag were the same rotating room. And they use that later when the kid got tied up with the tongues.
Oh, man.
And he passed out because his arms were over his head. And they had to like – he's like, I think that's why they hired me because like I just didn't complain much.
I can just imagine what's going through like the mind of like a crew member during that scene. It's just like, what am I doing in my life?
Yeah. Dude, something awesome.
Yeah. And in that Never Sleep Again, they had, you know, normally these are reserved for music videos where you do a lot of hours, at least for me. But they had days that were like 21 hours on these films.
Man.
And that means you have to like turn around in like six and come back to work. So like these were grueling films to make. So I don't know. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Man. So it's not all fun and games on a movie shoot, huh?
Oh, they're terrible. It's just a bunch of surly people. actually, the guy from New Nightmare was joking around. The guy who played the prop master in New Nightmare, he's like, so they made me the prop guy, but I looked, you know, I was like the wimpiest looking prop guy in the history of the world. Because when you meet prop guys, they're like the saltiest dude you'll ever meet.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was kind of funny from New Nightmare.
You know, I gotta say, like, in a lot of movies, it bothers me sometimes. Well, not bothers me, but you kind of roll your eyes before you enjoy the rest of the scene when you see how concepts are borrowed from movie to movie. You know, when clearly a director is taking another director's idea or a writer is taking a former writer's idea. And in like the first three, and I like referencing the first three Nightmare on Elm Street movies, because 4, 5, and Freddy's Dead is where it kind of got comic book, video game zany and cartoonish. But like in the first three movies, there were a lot of themes. And yeah, sure, Wes Craven was involved with Jack Shoulder for the general writing of part two. He was involved in character writing for part three, less and less involved. But there were a lot. I mean, you know, part one, we get those boiler room scenes, right? Really eerie. And the alley scenes. And then in part two, it goes to the power plant where Freddy worked. In part three, it goes to this junkyard where his remains were buried. And in all three of them, you know, it's dark. There's a lot of just old metal, rusty stuff. There's a lot of things for him to drag his claws against. There are a lot of shadows. It's always dark and dreary. Like, that's one of those themes that I thought really worked, especially in part one. Like, what would you think of those themes and all the silhouette shots of Freddy, for example?
I mean, they definitely did change from film to film. The first one, I think it was kind of Wes Craven working some stuff out. The second one was very interesting. I mean, you know, they call it like the first openly gay horror film, right? Is that what they were talking about?
They're calling it that now. And it's interesting that back then they didn't. And even this is very recent, by the way. Well, so really recently, I had posted something on a Facebook forum for Nightmare on Elm Street. And it was, I'll even go more recent. More recently, there was a Kickstarter campaign for Mark Patton, who played the star Jesse in Noe's Part 2. And they were talking about him and Jack Shoulder, the director, and how immensely openly gay this movie was. But a few weeks before this was advertised, I was posting about this on Facebook, and a bunch of people were basically calling me an asshole and saying, it wasn't open, it wasn't gay, it wasn't sexual, it was just a movie. And I'm gay, I didn't think it was gay. And I'm just looking back at this movie and thinking, are you serious? But either way, then it came out, and then there's this documentary. Mark, where were you going? You were going to take us somewhere.
Yeah, in the documentary, they interviewed the crew, the directors, the producers, the actors, and you know, some people didn't really get it. But I mean, there are the scenes where the coach, you know, they find him at the leather bar, then he's literally attacked by balls, and then a towel snaps his butt. You know, the production designer, they were talking about Mark, the lead star of the film. He was basically like the final girl, but he was the final guy. He was saying that the production designer was gay on the film. So there was a board game called Probe on his door. There was a sign that said, no chicks allowed. So, I mean, the subtext was actually right in your face. And Robert Englund made a joke. He's like, man, they love that movie in Europe. Like, he's like, they ate up all that stuff. It made a lot of money. But yeah, so like, that's one thing I respect about the Nightmare on Elm Street series is they do differ from film to film, and they do take some pretty crazy chances with them. So I don't know. I kind of respect that about the series.
Do you think that's the reason why it had such a consistent ROI across each entry in the series?
I mean, it never got boring, right. And Freddy was a total phenomenon.
Yeah.
So I mean, if people would have disliked two, they wouldn't have come out in droves for three. Like, three was a massive moneymaker. So, I mean, audiences must have loved two because it had some interesting thing. Like, it had, you know, like, it had a really weird dance scene. Yeah. And then, well, you know, that kid practiced that, and then they filmed it, and then the director's like, that wasn't really what I was looking for, but we just put it in the movie. But, I mean, I don't know. People must have been looking for a, you know, they love Freddy. Freddy was a rock star. I mean, he was making TV appearances. He even had his own rap album, I think, after the fourth one. So, I think it's just like, but it is definitely a case of horror franchises making something terrible. You know, Rob Zombie, we were talking about him earlier, and how, you know, whenever you watch a movie of his, you have to take a shower afterwards because you're literally covered in dirt. Like, it looks like, you know, when bombs explode in cartoons and like the characters are all just covered in soot.
Oh yeah.
Like, we're like chimney sweeps in England, basically, in the 18th century.
We're Dick Van Dyke and Mary Poppins.
Yeah, exactly. But the chimney sweep that's in there. Like so, but Rob Zombie was like, Nightmare on Elm Street was a dirty, gritty film. And like every sequel, like most horror films, they went away from that. You know, the second one they kept a little bit, but they completely ditched. Well, yeah, a little bit in the second, but they kind of completely ditched it in the third one, where they have, you know, him doing one-liners, and they changed the continuity in the second one because Freddy could actually come out in the real world. So what do you think, Levin Good?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. So that was actually another trend, by the way, that I'll use to segue into that. But like, one of the trends is that we see Freddy evolve in the movies. In the first movie, we're introduced to this boogeyman who can kill us in our dreams. In the second movie, or actually I'll skip, in the third movie, he finds a way to, by his own discretion, completely by his own discretion, come into reality, which is what he does in the junkyard scene in part three, when John Saxon and the psychiatrist are trying to bury his remains, and he animates his own skeleton to defend himself.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Now, in part two, there was an intermediary. He starts to take over Jesse, Mark Patton, the actor's body. But of course, the interesting subtext there is that in these movies are, at least the first three, are loaded with a lot of sexual and or perverse subtext, higher in some movies than others, is that back in a time, and again, this is not a statement for a soapbox or anything, but this is coming from a time when people were treating being gay as something that you could control, that could be fixed sometimes. You know, I mean, it was very controversial. And in reality, that's nonsense. But in this movie, Freddy is taking over Mark Patton's body when all this homosexual subtext is taking place. He takes over Mark Patton, or that is the character Jesse's body, when he encounters his gym coach at a bar where they're wearing leather vests and no shirts, and the bartenders have no shirts but leather studded wristlets, and he takes them to the school, makes them run laps in sweats, and then Marshall Bell is watching him in the shower with his bare butt, like it's a shower scene in any random horror movie with a girl. So like, Freddy is taking over the body at the same time that this is happening, and that's an interesting statement, in my opinion, of how Freddy is manipulating this person with all the subtext that's going on. And also another trend, by the way, just because it's another vector for showing how Freddy comes into the real world. In the first movie, Nancy had to pull him. In the second, he was using someone's body. He was using a vector.
And he interrupted a pool party. What a dick.
Yeah.
And he interrupted a pool party. Evidently killed a bunch of kids.
Yeah. Imagine that, John. You have the party of the year, right? You're just like, yo, pool party, Aquabats, my house. I got hot dogs and chips. Yeah. You have a massive party. Then this dream monster comes out and starts slashing people to death.
Okay, I should have known.
You just brought up a good point from both of the first movies. Do you think that if you're Wes Craven and you know everything that's going on in these movies, regardless of what we see on the screen, did these movies happen or were these movies all dreams?
They
happen.
So at the end of part one, we see Nancy running into a car with her friends who were all killed, but now they're alive. But only now she seems to be in a dream with them, where Freddy is sort of the car and Freddy pulls her mother, who's alive again, through the window, right? And then part two both begins and ends with a weird hint that this is presently in a dream.
Well, Wes Craven didn't want that at the end of the first one. He wanted just to end. Like, but they made him put that car in at the end.
Like, but it's there. It's there now in the finish.
Yeah, but he hates it. He hates it. So I
he
think,
hates?
Yeah, so Wes Craven created it. He hates it. So I think it happened.
Oh, poor guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so if we remove the car, though, what do we think about it then?
It happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what about part two? Did part two happen?
Sure.
Yeah. They all happen.
Part two has a lot of stuff. Like, okay, so one of the weird things that happens in part two, I mentioned that bar that he goes to that seems to be sort of like a bondage or maybe
the police academy, the Blue Oyster. Remember that movie?
When they, yeah.
Those two guys always ended up in the Blue Oyster.
But so it seems to be a gay bar or maybe just a bondage bar or whatever. But so Jesse, though, he can't sleep, right? He's having hot flashes and he can't sleep in part two. He gets up in the middle of the night on a school night. He goes out to a bar. He's 17 years old. Mm-hmm. He goes out to a bar and orders a beer. They give him a beer.
Well, it was the 80s.
And then he ends up seeing his gym coach, and he goes with his gym coach to the high school gym, and he's running laps for him. Like, that wouldn't make me want to call the police or call for an adult, but whatever. But so that happens. And when I was watching this movie, I was certain that was a dream. I was certain it was a dream. And then in the movie, it turns out that it's supposed to not be a dream.
Yeah, after watching a documentary, none of them ever talked about it just being a dream. So maybe I'm a little jaded by that because they never mentioned it.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure it happened.
And if it was a dream, Kurt Russell would come out and punch him all in the face.
There you go. You can't
argue with that everybody
logic.
Around at that bar.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But Dream Master is quite possibly the third one, the fan favorite of all the Nightmare on Elm Street films, yeah?
Yeah. I'd say so. And I've put a lot of posts on a lot of different Facebook Nightmare on Elm Street pages, and it seems to me that if you're referring to the best sequel specifically, not best movie of the franchise, but best sequel of the franchise, people always say either that or New Nightmare. And they seem to say part three way more often.
And New Nightmare was number 8 on the top 10 of all time, statistically speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah. New Nightmare was 12. I'm sorry. New Nightmare was 12 and Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors. Those are the 12th and 5th. Statistically speaking, best horror sequels.
And the best franchise, number 8, was Nightmare on Elm Street, just as a reminder. So, yeah, pretty powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I think 3 works for is, like, you have these nice kids. Patricia Arquette is awesome. And then the effects were pretty amazing in the third one because the entire budget just went to effects. But at the time, they were pretty groundbreaking with, like, the bodies in his – remember he opened up his shirt, right? And there was the bodies in there.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like the souls.
Oh, man.
And then, like, you know, that giant lizard-looking thing, which actually they thought was too phallic at first. So, like, paint it green and black so it doesn't look like a big, you know,
yeah,
phallic symbol sucking somebody up. And, like, I don't know. Like, you had Harry Potter before Harry Potter. You had some, like, really cheesy lines. But you had kids that you liked. And, like, I think, you know what? You know why maybe it worked for the younger kids is it kind of empowered younger kids because if they were afraid of Freddy, maybe in their brains it could be like, well, I could fight him in my dreams, even though this is just a movie. But, you know, if you look at this series over the years, kids really started to embrace Freddy, and they think that's because they wanted to make something really scary kind of friendly and, you know, homogenized.
I mean, part three was like the first Freddy movie that was fun at the time. I mean, now they're all fun because they all feel a little more hokey when you look back, like it's not quite as scary. But part three was the one that really started the original kills. And I don't mean original like Tina getting killed spinning around a spinning room in part one, right? I mean, like, the kills got really original. And they even complemented that by each of the characters had a special superpower while they were in the dream world in part three. The wheelchair-bound role-playing game kind of geek. I'm calling him a geek, guys, by the way, but I played Dungeons & Dragons, so don't think I'm dating.
I think he's cool nowadays.
Right, but back then he wasn't.
Yeah.
But so the wheelchair-bound D&D guy, and he liked being wizards in his D&D game. Well, he had wizard powers in his dream. But then Freddy used his weakness, like this wheelchair from hell with spikes and everything, like to combat him. And there was a drug addicted kind of punk girl who in her dream world, she had this super high, like 70s England punk style mohawk and these two switchblades. But he used her addiction with these syringe like gloves with, you know, blue fluid. And he jams them in her veins like to kill her. And I mean, it's a different example for every character.
Can I say something real quick?
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to prime time, bitch.
Oh,
that's right.
Yeah.
And the girl who wanted to be an actress, who is the least memorable character in the whole thing, gets one of the most famous lines in the whole movie. Yeah, when Freddy transforms from a TV, which, by the way, is another theme. You see his head push its way through the top of the TV and kind of form through it as it pushes through. We see him do that through Jesse's stomach in part two, and we see him do it through the wall above Nancy's bed in part one.
Yeah. That's a pretty effective.
Yet another one of those themes that every director and writer liked.
It's a pretty effective visual.
Ripped it off in The Frighteners.
Yeah. I have this special edition DVD cover where it kind of mimics that a little bit.
I love that Frighteners poster.
Yeah. I'm going to go try and find it, but in the meantime, Let's take a break real quick.
Hey, y'all, it's Mark. And for you, the listeners of Movies, Films, and Flicks, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, there's a book that I really recommend to you guys, and since we've been talking about horror films tonight, it's a book called Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. It's a wonderful book. It's about 9 hours long, but it walks you through how Alien, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, how the classics were made, Rosemary's Baby. And if you're a fan of horror, if you're a cinephile, and if you're just a fan of classic cinema, I totally recommend Shock Value. It's a wonderful book by Jason Zinnemann. Totally recommend it. So to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/shark. Again, that's audibletrial.com/shark for your free audiobook.
Robert.
Mm-hmm.
John.
Yes.
Complete the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. What are we doing?
Counting.
Counting what?
Down?
Counting down what?
Everything? Everything and anything.
Anything and everything.
That's right. The three of us, we count down from 5 down to 1. Top 5, everything and anything that you can think of. You want to know the top 5 shittiest bands? You want to know the top 5 movies? Listen, Shark Dropper Studios, sharkdropper.com.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. So I found that Frighteners poster, and yeah, it creeps me out. It looks like a face is coming out of the wall.
Can I tell you a story about how I watched The Frighteners?
Please.
So when I was in St. Pete, I went to Tyrone 6 maybe when I was – actually, when did The Frighteners come out? Let me look this up.
Tyrone 6 was a dingy little theater in the local mall for those of you who
– I was in 1996 or 97?
Yep, 96. Yeah. And we went to get tickets for Frighteners, and the lady went, no. So really? We went to for Multiplicity. And the lady was a jerk because she walked us to Multiplicity.
Right.
And I love that movie, dude. I'll Michael Keaton all day. You know, we had a good time actually watching that because, you know, I love me some Michael Keaton, some Andy McDowell. You know, I'm down.
Yeah.
But then I went back to my mom's house because I went to St. Pete every other weekend. I went to my mom's house. My mom dropped me off at a movie theater, and I saw this couple. And I was like, hey, what movie are you guys going to watch? Like, Frighteners. I'm like, can you get me a ticket? And they were like, yeah, you little feral kid. We will gladly get you a ticket to The Frighteners. And I sat there and I watched and I loved The Frighteners.
And they called you a feral kid.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I kind of looked like the kid from Mad Max.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of had like the loincloth and like all that kind of stuff. And I had a boomerang.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. Lemongood, I think you got the final listener question for us today.
Yes, I do. Third listener question comes from Isaac's Haunted Beard from Twitter, and he also handles isaacshauntedbeard.blogspot.com. And he asks a little more abstract question than we're used to. He asks, why is Michael Myers' mask referred to as the shape? What shape are we talking about? Is it the shape of horror?
So I'm thinking, like, you know, I looked at some research, whatever, and it said that a lot of the when you see like the kid or Michael Myers, the actor gets the credit, but when you just see him with the mask, they call that the shape. But I'm gonna ignore that. I'm just gonna say that I don't know. He was ultimate evil. He had eyes as black as night. His evil was unexplained, and I just felt like he was just this evil shape in that film. I mean, sure, it was a mask, you know, sure, it may not hold up, but in that film, he was pure evil. And I look at that more as a shape as opposed to, like, I don't know, anything else.
The shape of evil.
Yeah, he was the shape of evil.
I don't know. It's kind of weird. I've never heard it referred to as the shape before. I don't know. I don't usually Google before before these podcasts, so I could be missing out. I think my reaction to this question is, you know, the creepy thing about the Michael Myers mask is that it has a human shape, but it doesn't have any human features. You know, it's painted white. We all know that it's like a William Shatner mask, and they just like paint it over all the human features. So you see like, you see Michael Myers, like, you can tell it's a human face, but there's no defining human features. Like, there's no facial hair. You can't really make out, like, you know, the lips or, like, the eyes. It's all very creepy, you know. It's creepy because you can't quite put your finger on it, even though you can see it.
I'm really happy that mask didn't have a mustache on it.
It would be less, well, depending on the what type of mustache.
Like, I mean, it was the 70s.
Like, if it's like a classic movie villain mustache where he kind of twirls it at the end.
But if it was a Kurt Russell mustache, his head would have just been leaning down the whole time.
Yeah, there's no way. He's got the neck strength to support that facial hair.
All right, so write that down on paper. Mike Myers does not have the neck strength to support a Kurt Russell mustache.
Wow. I mean, there were some features, but you can only tell, like, when, because I recently saw on like Facebook or something, I think it was Twitter, where they had the Bill Shatner Star Trek mask right next to the Shape mask that was painted white, and you can see a lot of the characteristics. But, you know, one of the really interesting things is, first off, the hair is messed up on the Michael Myers mask. Like, they intentionally straightened or messed up the hair. And the other thing is that they, like, plucked the eyebrows on the Michael Myers mask. I'm not kidding. The eyebrows are smaller. They have been plucked down.
Yeah.
So I think the Shape is referring to Michael Myers' manicured eyebrows.
I mean, if you think about it, he has taken care of himself throughout the years. Like, this is a man who's absolute evil, but yet he, like, lives in houses, he eats rats, like, he plays the lotto. I mean, you know, he takes care of himself. He must brush his teeth. So, yeah, I mean, maybe he has a nice shape. Maybe he takes care of his figure when he's locked down in the basement waiting for the next Halloween.
Well, you don't know what his teeth look like under the shape.
That's what I'm saying. They could be great.
The thing about the eyebrows, though, is that it's kind of a genius move on the designer's part, because the eyebrows convey emotion. You know, when you remove the eyebrows, you remove, like, another human element, and that's emotion. It's kind of like the opposite of the
They're just smaller.
Yeah, you can't make him out.
There's less room to maneuver. You know what I mean? He's not doing, like, he's not doing Blue Steel.
You can't tell if he's angry. You can't tell if he's happy. He's just there.
If Michael Myers had 70-year-old Jewish attorney eyebrows, they'd be, like, reaching out for you like the Whomping Willow in Harry Potter.
So they'd be, like, evil.
Or, like,
so they can't be too big.
Or, like, Uncle Leo in that Seinfeld episode when he had the eyebrows kind of painted on. Everyone thought he was just angry.
Those things were prehensile.
Yeah. So I think that's the answer to the question. Uncle Leo's eyebrows in Seinfeld.
I like it.
Yeah. All right, Love and Good. I think I'll leave it to you to continue the topic we were talking about previously.
All right, well, as we can kind of continue our unofficial Wes Craven tribute part two, we're going to go into another Wes Craven franchise and just start spouting off our random ravings. And we're going to get into the Scream movie series. Now, Mark has really championed the Scream series, and this kind of like New Nightmare, which was a meta movie before we had meta movies in 1994. This movie took meta movies to a new level. Mark, you're a champion of Scream 2, and I want to know, what connects the bridge from Wes Craven's New Nightmare to Scream?
Now, I just want to say, first and foremost, my nickname is Marcus Aurelius Decimus Screamus.
Yeah, I call him Matt Screamus.
Yep. So, you know, I'm a Scream scholar. Yeah. You know what I mean? I'm Scream corn. You know what I mean? Okay. Wait, what does that mean? But so, you know, 1994, Wes Craven's New Nightmare happened. Kevin Williamson, the writer, got an idea, like, oh, hey, this is kind of meta. I'm going to write a script about, you know, teenagers that live in a world where they've seen horror movies. They tap Wes Craven to direct it. And since, you know, the early 90s were pretty weak on horror, it exploded in 96. And I mean, all right, so listen, Scream 1 made $183 million, adjusted for inflation, of course.
Now, what kind of budget are we talking about with that $183 million?
So it had $183 million, and the budget was $14 million.
Woo!
That's right.
Oh man,
we're Ric Flair in these budgets, guys. So the second one with inflation made $177 million. The budget was $24 million. That's a woo, right? All right. The third one was It made $134 million with a budget of $40 million.
But
I mean that's ROI. That's two right there. I'm not going to talk about the fourth one. No, I like the fourth one, but it didn't make money.
What was it?
Well, in a $40 million budget, and it only made $38 million. So that's more of like a meh.
That's a whoa.
That's because everyone just knew that Anna Faris was already cashing out for real movies.
That's right. So, I mean, just think about it. R-rated horror movies making $183 million today.
It's unheard of.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
That's like super.
That doesn't happen. And the thing is that even if you adjusted your budget for inflation when you were given those Scream and Scream 2 stats, I'm sorry, Scary Movie 2, but the Scream movies did well. Even if you adjust for inflation, movies do better kind of with each successive year. Like every year we're breaking records.
Yeah, and in the sequel world of horror that we've talked about, there's a massive drop-off. So, you know, Scream 3 didn't make that much. Well, it made over $100 million. But the drop-offs of the first three are unparalleled. I mean, these were event movies. I mean, these are – I just love that, you know, R-rated slasher bloody movies, three of them in a row made at least $125 million. Like, that's rare in horror. And, I mean, if you think about the first one, it was equal parts satire and just straight-up bloody. The second one I think is probably the best – pound for pound horror sequel ever made. I wrote an article about it, and I just think that, you know, Scream 1 hit in 1996, right? They're like, hey, we need a Scream 2, and you need to have it out in a year. So 357 days in that timeline, they had to write a script. There was an outline by Kevin Williamson, but they had to write a script. They had the cast roles. They had the scout locations. They had to film it. They had to edit it and release it in theaters. Take into account the script that leaked, which cost them 2 months. So basically in 10 months, this movie had to get, you know, written, and from script to screen, it had to get produced. No other horror film, or films for that matter, have been that good a year after the original.
It had no room for error, but it still was able to hit the target. Like, it was a critical and box office success.
Yeah, and it's a sequel that has a higher critical rating than the first one, and that rarely happens in horror. That never happens in horror.
So you mentioned something about the script getting leaked and they changed something up. And isn't that linked to something that Wes Craven, he used to like joking that he didn't want to be like Friday the 13th. He didn't want just someone to get like randomly stabbed with a shock and that's the kill. He always wanted more. But of course, in Friday the 13th, there was a good shock at the end. And that's that it was in fact not Jason, but Jason's mother that was the killer. It wasn't until part two that he was the killer. And in part two of Scream, it was Billy's mother from part one who we didn't see. But Billy's mother is the killer, and Cotton Weary, who we thought was the killer in part one, turns out to be the person who saves the day. So they pulled like a double reverse. Like they totally zigged when we thought they were going to zag.
I mean, they zigged. Ooh. We zagged. They zigged. And then we tried to zig with them, and they zagged. Like there's no zigzagging with them. You know what I mean? Like
That crocodile was running straight while I was running zigzag trying to get away, and he caught me.
Yeah. I think I'm
he's
getting
like
vertigo.
He's like Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, where that kid's running in a straight line, and Leatherface somehow zigs and zags all the way in front of him and chops off his leg. But yeah, like, you know, it was supposed to be Haley, Neve Campbell's roommate, Sydney's roommate in the second one, and she was the girlfriend of Timothy Oliphant, but then they switched it to the mom. So there were script changes, and there was 357 days, and they still provided a satisfying ending. And when you think about horror movies, endings that a lot of endings don't nail their triple indies. Like, they belly flop. This movie nailed its ending, and it had no right to. Like, this is unparalleled in horror history.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the kills in these movies, Mark. So what made part one really stand out to you? So this was kind of like a meta movie. It was kind of satirical, but what about the kills worked? Because this is Wes Craven. He was known for fueling interesting kills.
So the first death is Drew Barrymore's boyfriend. And what's crazy about that is the jock boyfriend puts up no fight and gets gutted in the first couple minutes. That never happens. The second is one of the best kills that you'll, you know, ever see in a horror film is Drew Barrymore, this massive star, gets strung up and gutted in the first 10 minutes of a horror film.
Totally unexpected. Totally unexpected.
No one saw it. And like, you know, you saw her. She was like stabbed and she was reaching for the phone. You did not expect for her mom to walk out and see her gutted and like with her tongue sticking out. And then also the first one, you know, Rose McGowan got killed by an industrial strength garage door opener.
That was the strongest garage door opener ever.
Yeah, that was your line, loving good. And then Matthew Lillard, right? He's stabbing himself to be like, oh, hey, we tried to save you. You know, he's one of the killers. But he ends up dying. But I love, you know, it had a sense of humor. He stabs himself, and then he's like, oh, my mom's going to kill me when the cops are coming. Like, the movie had a sense of humor. There was satire, but it was also brutal. So it walked a very fine line of self-aware but not too smug. But it also gave horror fans what they wanted, which was incredibly bloody and unexpected kills.
And I love that, too, when Matthew Lillard is being questioned, I think, by Neve Campbell before they're going to kill her. And she says, what got you to do this in the first place anyway? Peer pressure. I'm very sensitive. Like, she says, yeah, well, I just called the cops. It's like, oh, my mom and dad are going to kill me.
That's like, yeah, and it's an improv line. And as you can see throughout the series is Wes Craven had total – faith in his actors. Jamie Kennedy, Courtney Cox, David Arquette, they had a lot of room to kind of improvise and work on their characters. And that's why I think the first three movies, and to a certain extent the fourth, work so well, is because the actors were invested in their characters and they liked their characters. And because of that, the audience liked their characters. So when Jamie Kennedy dies during the daytime unceremoniously in a van in the second one, it punches you right in the face. The kills mattered in these movies.
I got to say, that in part two especially, there were two kills that really shocked the shit out of me. One of them was opening scene. You got Jada Pinkett on her date. She wanted to go see the Sandra Bullock movie, but instead she's dragged to see the free screening of the horror movie Stab with her boyfriend Omar Epps. And everyone's dressed up and everyone has, you know, fake knives and everything. So when she's getting stabbed by the killer in front of everybody at the movie theater, people are seeing this happen. And she's getting stabbed like five times with 3 to 5 second gaps in between, looking around, gasping for help. And everyone's just watching. Right? I mean, that was brutal. And you got Sarah Michelle Gellar. She gets stabbed and then just abruptly thrown from a second floor balcony. So those kills I thought were really transformative. They were unexpected. They were unlike the genre at the time. What kills for you two really helped make the Scream franchise, other than those kills and the Drew Barrymore kill? What really stood out to you? And the garage door opener, Rose McGowan kill.
No,
made this work.
I know you love the Drew Barrymore kill, but were there any kills that you liked other than the Drew Barrymore?
I mean, I was gonna say Jada Pinkett's. I like the opening kills.
Yeah.
You know, because I feel like opening kills, like they have to be like kind of the flashiest. They also have to set the tone for the whole movie. I just feel like the Drew Barrymore kill just like set the tone for the whole franchise, and it was just. I was just totally unexpected. I don't know.
I gotta go with. I mean, Dewey lived in the second one, but in the second one, Dewey gets stabbed to death in like a soundproof room. Like Gail's banging on the thing, and they have great chemistry, Courtney Cox and David Arquette. And so she's banging on this thing, and he can't hear her. And you think he's dead, and he just gets stabbed about seven times, pulls a Luke Wilson in Vacancy, and lives. But like blood comes from his mouth and wipes on the glass. And like, when's the last time you've actually liked characters that died in a horror film? Like, seriously, like the Final Destination characters, I don't think I've ever liked. The Saw characters, I don't think I've ever liked.
No.
Friday the 13th, I don't think I've ever liked. I mean, it's very rare where you like the people in horror movies getting killed. And in Scream 2, you had Jamie Kennedy. And then when I thought David Arquette died, I was like, I'm out. I quit. Like, I'm done. Like, it hurt my soul. Yeah, those were tough kills.
Yeah.
For sure. So, yeah, that's
it. These movies really are, like, before they were big stars, like, anthems. Because the first one, you have a huge cast. But in the second one, they all come back. Then you got Jerry O'Connell, Timothy Oliphant, Sarah Michelle Geller, Jenny McCarthy. Like, the cast just kind of explodes on us. And, of course, back then, these people weren't big, but it makes it so much more fun to go back and watch.
Yeah, and I was so happy to see Timothy Olyphant. If you guys know the podcast, you know I love Justified. Like, I'm a big Timothy Olyphant fan. It was just like that was one of his first movies. And you know what else I loved about Scream 2, along with, like, you know, Sarah Michelle Gellar, you don't really see her getting killed, like Buffy and everything. But what I liked about Scream 2 is it was self-aware without being smug. Like, you know how many movies are, like, aware of themselves and they're just annoying? Like, this one talked about horror sequels, and it talked about the rules of sequels. There are certain rules that one must abide in order to create a successful sequel. Number one, the body count is always bigger. Number two, the death scenes are always much more elaborate. More blood, more gore, carnage, candy. And number three, never, ever, under any circumstances, assume the killer is dead. Now, also, we forgot to talk about this, but the car scene, the cop car scene, where I think it's Haley and Sydney have to crawl over Ghostface. Like, when I was in a packed theater watching that scene, everybody went insane. Like, that was like, you, like, two people crawled over the killer and lived. Like, that's unprecedented. Like, they found ways to mess with you and keep it fresh.
It was just so intense. It was like, oh, don't do it. Actually, no, do it. Do it. Do it.
And, like, you know, I was like, why doesn't she bash his face in? But I'm also like, I've never had to crawl over a serial killer, so I'm not really going to judge.
You know, so you make the comment about bashing his face in. It makes me think, this is satirical, and it's very meta cinematographical, to make up a word. And so while being a meta movie and being a satire at the same time, the killer has all these, like, shocking kills that we mentioned. They're almost, again, transformative for the genre. But at the same time, the killer is the one tripping over everything, you know? So Neve Campbell, normally Wes Craven gives us a lot of very strong female characters in his whole filmography. But here, we really just have Courtney Cox and Neve Campbell playing strong female characters. The others are more typical. But this killer, every single time he encounters a girl, they get a few hits in. They kick him in the shin, he falls. He grabs him by the ankle and they fall, they kick him in the face. They open up a refrigerator door and knock him over like it's a Jackie Chan movie or a Three Stooges episode. And I'm stressing this, every time the killer misses with a swing of his knife, he falls over whatever is nearest by.
Yeah.
And that still worked, though. I didn't lose a lot of credibility. That somehow worked with the intensity of the kills. How do you feel about all that?
This is my theory on why he's so clumsy. I feel like the eye holes on the mask, they're not – you can't really see through them.
So they're not practical.
Yeah, the killer can't actually see. That's why he's tripping over everything.
He's like the stormtroopers. Like, yeah, they can't see anything. But also, do you think this is Wes Craven? Freddie had a really awkward walk and was goofy. The guys from Hills Have Eyes, you know, they were not graceful at all. I think it kind of continues the realistic killer that Wes Craven kind of had in some of his classic films. I mean, this guy, when he's swinging, these people don't know how to work knives. Like, they're not like knife experts. They're not Benicio del Toro in The Hunted.
Ooh, nice.
They're gonna swing. That's a pretty deep. I should have said Tommy Lee, yeah. But they're, you know, when they swing and miss, they're gonna fall. And I like that about them. Like, these are not professional, you know, killers.
Yeah, they're just they're amateurs mostly, and it shows. And there's something kind of quote unquote endearing about that.
Yeah,
about these killers. So.
Yeah, and like, and they still get the people, and it prolongs the death too. Like, there's something, you know what? It might give you hope. You're like, oh, this guy just fell over a coffee table. Hey, he just fell over another coffee table. He is completely submerged in a fish tank, a salt fish tank. How'd they get that coral in there?
It's reminiscent of like a Three Stooges bit.
Yeah, you know, like you just like, yeah, and then he still gets the person, and I think it prolongs it and makes it even more dangerous because you feel like these people are human and you can't, like The Descent. He wanted those creatures to be killable. So maybe that's why Wes Craven did that.
I just want to see like Three Stooges bit with the scream killer. Like he goes like poke someone in the eyes and they block it.
I don't know why they made those noises. Oh, bugger, 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 bugger.
They're Stooges. Why did they do anything?
That's right. But no, I think, you know, they made a lot of money. That's unprecedented with horror sequels. And, you know, the fourth one fell off a bit, but I don't know, like they all have their distinct personalities. I thought the third one was written by Aaron Kruger, and it was a departure, but it was still a lot of fun. Like, Parker Posey is always good. I mean, it has a lot of comedy gags. There's that scene where they're like, the people that smell the gas live, and then the one guy blows himself up. So the killer...
While he's reading the line, yeah.
The killer's, like, sending faxes, and, like, you know, he has it all planned out. It's just ridiculous. I mean, I had fun with the third one, and so, I mean... I think it's a consistent franchise.
You know, part three maintained a lot of fun, and it followed the same trends from part one to two versus two to three with the characters. Like, the characters got snarkier. Dewey got more idiosyncratic and dewier, and Courtney Cox got more fame, or that is Gail Weathers. She got more famous and pushier, and Neve Campbell got ever more paranoid, and Jamie Kennedy's character Paul, I think, he got sharper in all of his analyses. The thing is that while all those things were developed really well in part three, I feel like part three didn't really deliver the intensity or the twists that we saw from part one to part two. In fact, I don't feel like we saw any real departure in quality from part two. Yeah. Other than following character trends. Now, I say that part three was a lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed part three. It's just that part two was a lot of fun and it impressed the hell out of me.
You know what's interesting about part three is if you look at like Army of Darkness or Nightmare on Elm Street 3, they become a lot cheekier. Mm. So it's like Scream 3 so self-aware that it made itself less violent and more cheeky because that's what third films traditionally do?
Oh, wow.
Maybe. It didn't work for overall entertainment value to me, but there are two scenes that I think work with your theory. One, Dewey is talking to the detective, played by Patrick Dempsey. Patrick Dempsey says something to him, and he says, "Is that a threat?" Patrick Dempsey says, "You'll know it when I'm giving you a threat." And then Dewey says, "Is that a threat?" And then the other scene is Jenny McCarthy, who I'm sorry I referenced earlier. Jenny McCarthy is in part three, not part two. But in the very beginning, like they reference a shower scene. And then later, she's talking about that shower scene and how cliche that is in horror movies. So, like, yeah, they're going out of their way to really embrace stuff. And But at the same time, I think they're playing the same stuff out. They're making Stab 3 in the movie. You know, the video from the dead seemed like a little bit of a push from Jamie Kennedy, even though I enjoyed it and I enjoyed the details in it. I don't know. Again, very enjoyable movie. Highly recommended. If you like part one and two, I say see part three. But part three didn't carry its weight for a sequel to parts one and two for me.
Yeah, if you're you know, your boat is sinking, you know, one and two are the people you want with buckets. You know what I mean?
So, so if one and two are the buckets and three is potentially, I don't know, the big fish that jumps in that starts weighing you down.
No, it's like a ladle.
A ladle. All right, a ladle. In a world of buck when we need buckets. What's part four?
A spork.
when you're in the boat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's like a butter knife. I was like, oh.
Yeah, it's a gosh. You can still get some water out, but you're just going to do more harm.
Yeah.
With four, you know, it was 11 years later. I mean, the body count was really high. It was incredibly bloody. It had a great opening. It was still smart. But you know what I think was lacking from the fourth one was just the magic. You know, like, it didn't have to happen. And it just felt, it didn't feel organic, but I still liked it. Well, but it also felt a little bit behind the times.
Here's the thing, yeah, like you just said, first Scream was like the beginning of like kind of a mini horror renaissance that started in the 90s. Scream 4 came out like towards the tail end of that.
What was that, 2011?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, by then when Scream 4 came out, like it didn't really blow anybody away by just, you know, originality or just it being like a breath of fresh air. It was the fourth installment of a franchise. You know, I feel like that was like two strikes against it right there.
Mm-hmm. And, someone said that it wasn't self-referential. It was self-reverential. Like it kind of got by on being Scream 4.
Yeah.
And like the only things I really love about Scream 4 is just like watching Neve Campbell be like rookies and then just kicking butt. You know, like I like that. I had fun with that, but it didn't have the magic of. I mean,
no.
It's on its own, it's fine, but it just didn't have the magic of. All right, so the first two are the best. The third one is good. I mean, you can still get a lot of water out with a ladle, but
yeah,
it's not a bucket. So, no. You know, the ship definitely started getting weighed down a little bit before, and that's why it wasn't higher up in the franchise list. I mean, it made the top 10 franchises. It just wasn't, you know, four did not help its cause.
Well, it was a steep drop off from like 100 million plus to what, 38 million?
It just went.
And you know what? You referred to the magic of like part one, and it really probably is just that, because I can even transport myself to a less pretentious age when I wasn't so smart or snooty about horror in 1996. And even back then, if you had just asked me flat out what I'd think about a horror movie where the killer is wearing this outfit and you just show me a picture of the outfit, I'd just say that movie looks stupid. I'm never going to watch it. If you just showed me what the killer was going to wear, I'd be like, that's dumb. Like, Jason is cool, the weird hockey mask, and he's this mutilated zombie thing, and Freddy all burnt faced, or you know what I mean? But like, if you just saw a photograph of this thing, you'd be like, there's no style to that whatsoever. And yet, when watching the movies, I never questioned its legitimacy. I never found myself saying how stupid it was.
Yeah.
Even though it's just this random looking costume that you'd get at a costume store for $49.99 last minute before a costume party, you know, the night before. Like, I bought it. I never even thought about it until honestly just this minute, how silly the killer looks in all those movies.
Because he's always tripping over things.
And yet it works.
Yeah. All right. Well, gentlemen, I think we've reached the end of our podcast. Right? Unless someone else wants to add anything.
Is there someone that we're not aware of?
Yeah, hey, this is Rick. I've just been listening in.
And, oh, okay. All right. I didn't know we were taking live calls.
Yeah.
Oh, Joe Santori from New Jersey here. Oh, Rick, you don't know what you're talking about.
Hey, all right. Joe. Hey, Joe.
All right, guys. All right. I didn't know I'm taking two calls at once here.
Yeah, hey, knock it off. Knock it off. This is Rick.
All right, Rick, you go first. You go first, Rick.
So I like what you said.
Oh, thank you.
I like it. The nightmare stuff was good. I don't remember much of it.
It was well researched.
But that Scream stuff, let me tell you, I've cried twice in my life.
Okay.
The first time is when I tasted my mother's marinara sauce for the first time. All right.
I cried. Feel you.
Yeah. Cried. 6 months. Cried.
So good, right?
Second time is when that Kennedy fella got killed in the second Scream 2. Bawled my eyes out.
Hold on. Quick question. Were you eating your mother's marinara when you were watching that scene?
I was not. That's how good it is.
Oh, okay.
Right. So I'm watching it, right?
All
right. And I'm hiding these tears. The people are going, hey, you crying? Are you crying? I'm like, no. I'm just thinking about my mother's marinara, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to let you guys know, Scream 2, it's A+. A++. It's better than – it's not better than my mother's marinara, but, you know, it's better than Fazoli's.
All right. Thank you for the call. Yeah. All right. I think who's on the airline? Joe? Or
Ricky Santori here. Ricky Santori.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just saying, look, everything that they said about Scream is solid gold. My mother even agrees. My mother. You better than her?
Does your mother also make marinara? Or she make a nice Alfredo sauce?
That sounds disgusting, but it's meant not to be disgusting.
Okay. Yeah.
I've had a marinara. It's pretty good. it's like Scream 3 with the little Scream 2 in it.
Like, it's good, but it doesn't make you cry.
Yeah, I ain't crying with his mother's marinara.
You just let it sim in that. We got to stop.
Okay. that was a good one, guys. All right, we'll just do a quick plug. Check out moviesfilmsflix.com, sharkdropper.com.
And guys, listen, Sharkdropper does all original. They write it. They produce it. They do the sound effects. I mean, if there's a fart noise, you know, I'm sure John's making that fart noise. Yeah. All right, this is like original stuff. Support original material. You'll have a lot of, you know, like you can't beat it. It's solid gold. Solid gold A+ material.
Yeah. Terrible ROI. Terrible. I think it's negative. I think it's negative. But yeah, thank you. Check all that stuff out. Also, drop us a 5-star rating on iTunes if you can. That's always appreciated. And I think that's it.
Subscribe.
Yeah, subscribe.
And my mother will send you some marinara. I'm not promising nothing.
All right. Well, yeah. I don't know. I kind of want your mother's marinara now.
I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you.
All right. For my co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
Yeah, Mark left. Mark left. He's gone.
Oh, yeah, I know. But I'm just mentioning his name.
Yeah.
John Levengood.
Good night, everybody. Thank you for patiently dealing with our horrible impressions.
I've been your host, John Lasso. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you guys next time.
Terrible impressions.
Target. T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark. Go, go, go.
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.